He's Braden Gall. I'm Jason Fitz. Julian Council here producing. Buck Rising back at the studio doing all the hard work. And Kevin Kyle helping us engineer this as we are down in Hoover, Alabama for SEC Media Days. And, again, the best part of being down here is that we get to talk to people just flat out smarter and better at college football than we are. And now we get to talk to one of the best in the business. You see him on SEC Network. He also writes for Gridiron Now, Tony Barnhart. Tony, we appreciate your time this morning. Thanks for coming on with us.
Oh, good to be with you guys, yeah.
So there's a theory we've been bouncing around, and Braden told me I should throw this at you. If we were at, let's say, Big Ten Media Days, mm-hmm. and it was an hour away from campus for Ohio State, would they have the same sort of crazed lobby fan reaction that you see here being close to Alabama on Alabama Day?
Not a chance.
Okay.
No.
Thank you, Tony. I'm a winner. That's all I needed to hear from you.
They don't do this kind of – now, are the fans passionate? Are they – did it? Yeah. But what they would draw the line as for at getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning and driving down here and sitting in a lobby hoping for a glimpse of Urban Meyer. I've got a lot of Ohio State friends, and I don't see that happening. That doesn't mean they're better or worse or anything. When you drove up, you saw the sign on the building that said it just means more.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it just means more.
Well, and I think the SEC takes a lot of flack for that, and they kind of get it's almost like the SEC is channeling its inner Butch Jones and sort of putting the cheesy cliche. But it's true. I mean, that's the 1-14. There's not a league that matches the craziness, sometimes to a fault, of the SEC.
Well, and understand that it's not a game to the people in this part of the world. It's not. It's not a game. It's a way of life. They build their lives around college football season. Weddings, births, sometimes funerals are built around college football Saturdays. So
let me ask you then, because I'll use Dari Noka as an example. A couple of days ago we had Dari on.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about some of the if scenarios that don't look great for the SEC this year, particularly in play. And the comment was, if things don't go well, in his mind, the SEC could end up being the third best conference in college football this particular year.
Right.
How does that get turned around?
Well, I think it does. First of all, the way it gets turned around by having a little bit better players. One of my philosophies is there is no problem, with few exceptions, there's no problem in college football that can't be solved by recruiting better players. Inevitably, that's what does it. And the SEC is going to take a step back forward again this year, because last year there was a ton of freshmen and redshirt freshman quarterbacks. Those guys have grown up a year. 11 of 14 teams returned the quarterback that started their last game of the season. So I think they're going to do that. But here's the deal. Really, the SEC was sort of a victim of its own improvement, because the bottom part of the league raised their game. Kentucky raised their game. South Carolina raised their game after a 2-6 start. Vanderbilt beat Georgia, Tennessee, and Ole Miss down the stretch to go 6-6. And so there were fewer wins in the middle of the pack. So,
And I think that raises a question. I think there are seven teams in the SEC that have national championship DNA that they expect to win at a high level on a routine basis. Mm-hmm. Florida, Georgia, Tennessee, Auburn, LSU, Alabama, A&M. And A&M's sort of the weird one that hasn't actually done it over a period of time. But those fan bases, they're not going to settle for 9-3. But should they just so deep down inside, I think it was Mike Huguenin, who you were a colleague with, said that deep down inside, they all know they can't beat Bama. Should every fan base just sort of pump the brakes on their own expectations until Nick Saban finally retires and just accept 9-3?
They're totally incapable of doing that. They can't. even if they wanted to do it, they can't do it. So you just pursue Alabama as best and hard as you can. But you do, if you want to be realistic and understand that we are watching a run by Alabama that should not be possible in the 21st century.
Yep.
Given the resources that every team in this conference – now, you used to be Alabama was domino, or team was domino, because they had more money than everybody else, and they could go recruiting, and they could build facilities. Well, guess what? Everybody's got facilities. Everybody can pay their coach $4 or $5 million a year. Everybody can pay their coordinators $1 million plus a year. Everybody's got money now, and Alabama still dominates. And you shouldn't be able to do it, but they're doing it.
It's what, in my opinion, it's what makes Nick Saban the greatest coach of all time, because I think doing what he's doing in this era is significantly more difficult than any other era of college football.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, the most dominant era in this conference was 71-81, when Alabama won 116 games in 11 season. Think about that.
Yeah.
On a 10 or 11 game schedule, won 116 games, 9 SEC championships, and 3 national championships. And they did most of those years, they had 105 scholarships, okay, and had the edge in finances and stuff like that. So, like I've said, what Nick Saban is doing now, you should not be able to do, but he's done it.
We're talking to Tony Barnhart. I'm Braden and Fitz, ESPN 102.5 The Game. So I ask you, in the SEC culture today, should we just accept and appreciate this moment as a moment of greatness, or should we be just dreaming for any other second team to step up?
Well, you're going to be doing both. If you're smart, you're going to realize what's going on before you, and someday we're going to look back on this and go, wow, wasn't that incredible? But at the same time, if you're a fan of another, if you're a fan of Georgia, you're saying, why not us? Okay, we got everything at Georgia that Alabama's got, except Nick Saban. But guess what? We went out and got his number one guy, and we've got all the resources we need. And you sort of build toward that.
We joke about this. If Nick Saban were to say $50 million and I'll retire, how many days, how many minutes would it take the booster groups of every other SEC school to raise that money?
Just long enough to pass the hat. You know, yep. That's all it would take. You know.
No. $50 million SEC and I'll retire. It'd happen in an hour.
Absolutely.
I think you could take care of that in one church service in the South. We're just like, hey, we're all going to throw in, and it's all going towards the Nick Saban retirement.
But here's a problem with that theory. Alabama would make like 3 phone calls and double it to 100, and there you go.
Right,
there you go.
Right.
You know.
Tony Barnhart joining us here. You look at the defensive lines in this conference. We've rattled off the names that are gone off these teams. Mm. We've talked about the quarterbacks. Relative to its own level of success and talent, the SEC defensive lines look like they might be down. Do we expect to see some higher scoring football games this year?
Well, I think overall the offense is going to be better, and I think that's absolutely going to be part of it. And everybody understands that in this league now, this is not like the old days. You can't score 21 points and think that you're going to win a football game in this league. And that's a hard lesson that Les Miles at LSU had to find out, and it cost him his job at LSU. So, yeah, I think you're going to see more high-scoring games. But I always say, you know, whenever you say, well, you know, the defenses aren't going to be as good because Jonathan Allen's gone and all that, you know.
They got somebody else.
They got 5 dudes ready to take Jonathan Allen's place. And the same thing for the great defensive backs and linebackers around the league.
Can we agree, though? I mean, with the national conversation, the way it usually is in the media, if these young quarterbacks look good, it's going to be because people will say it's because the defenses are bad. And if the young quarterbacks look bad, it's going to be because the defense, like, there's no win here.
We got an argument for everything. We can argue both sides of the fence. The fact of the matter is the SEC will be a very difficult league to play in this year. And I always tell people, said, man, what makes the SEC so good? I said, go to Starkville, Mississippi, and play their 5-7 team on a Saturday night.
Yep.
See how that goes. See how hard it is to get out of there with a win. Go to Fayetteville,
Your
Arkansas.
Your ears will be ringing.
Yeah, Fayetteville, Arkansas with a 7-5 team. Play that team on a Saturday night. See how hard it is to get out of there with a win.
Let me ask you, while we've got you, Vanderbilt, somebody that felt like got a lot of buzz yesterday. Mm-hmm. Derek Mason won a lot of people over. Where are you on Vandy as a program?
I think the trajectory continues to go up. I mean, I sat with Derek Mason the spring after his first year, which was an unmitigated disaster, and he admitted, as he has to everybody, that he was a big part of that disaster. And he made the changes he had to make, difficult changes. They found their – he hires Andy Ludwig. They figure out what their identity is. He takes over the defense, Derek Mason. And that, since then, I mean, look at the way they finished last year. To beat Georgia at Georgia, to beat Ole Miss, which was a high-powered team, to beat – not only to beat Tennessee, but basically kick their butts up and down the field. That was very, very impressive. So now, veteran quarterback Ralph Webb, you know, and a defense that's going to continue to be good. The trajectory keeps coming up.
And to your point, I think he will admit that he has grown a lot and evolved and developed as a coach. It's fun to see because he's just bubbling with confidence right now. It's a lot of fun, Tony. Tennessee, certainly almost some counterculture right now against Tennessee. Like, everyone was so disappointed with their own picks last year. And they're blaming Tennessee for it, which they should, that they're all, hey, they could finish fifth, and Kentucky and South Carolina are better. Tennessee, more likely to finish fourth or fifth, or more likely to finish first?
More likely to finish third, which is where they're going to finish. The irony of Tennessee's situation now is and the fans don't want to hear this, but five new coaches, new athletic director, new quarterback, new chancellor. You know, call me crazy, but it sounds like a team in transition, and the fans don't want to hear that. But the irony of all that is that Tennessee, from an athletic standpoint, from the number of players, quality players they have in the program, they are deeper now than they have been at any time in the last 10 years since Philip Fulmer left.
Yep.
They've got more good football players in the program right now. Now, you lose the star power, so how do you play without the star power? Do numbers and depth compensate for the star power you lost? And that's what we're going to find out about Tennessee.
Fantastic stuff. Follow him on Twitter at MrCFB. Tony Barnhart, obviously we appreciate your time coming on today with us, man.
Okay, guys.
Thanks so much. Tony Barnhart, one of the best minds out there. Glad to get him. And we're going to go from Tony to Phil Savage, going to join us up next. We'll do that. Next up, Braden and Fitz, ESPN 102.5 The Game. He's Braden Gall. I'm Jason Fitz. Guys, you do not want to miss the 2017 Music City Fit Expo. It's Saturday, July 15th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Rocket Town. Rocket Town's down at 601 4th Avenue South. While you're there, you can meet experts in nutrition and wellness. You can network with fellow fitness buffs. You can learn how you can get more involved in the wellness community. It's a fantastic time. It's only down at the 2017 Music City Fit Expo. We're down in Hoover, Alabama, Braden Gall and I, getting you all caught up and all set for SEC Media Days. It is an absolute madhouse. It's an absolute zoo. We are efforting Phil Savage, who I believe is going to be joining us any minute, but he's being held hostage.
Everybody's pretty much in demand.
Oh, and just trying to walk through right now at this point is a
Are you seeing now that Nick Saban is about 15 feet away from us, are you seeing the zoo-ness of Alabama Day?
It's zoo-ish.
Alabama Day.
It's zoo-ish. It is definitely it's a different vibe here than it was the first few days, for sure. The first few days, a couple of people kind of quiet. But this hey, Buck, do we still have that earlier cut of what it sounds like in the lobby right now?
I want to be just like Alabama Man.
That's right. Alabama Man is there's a bunch of Alabama Man.
A lot of Alabama Man. It's really crazy, man. You've been here 3 days now, and Brett Bielema walked in and stood 20 feet over there, and Coach O walked through, and Derek Mason's walking through, and you know, Jim McElwain and Kirby Smart. Like, these are some stars of college football. And, like, nothing happens like that right there. Like, what's over there right now, which is 4,000 television cameras with professional lighting all shining down on one guy doing one radio interview on one booth, and his name is Nick Saban.
Well, it's a chaotic, it's a madhouse, and it's almost one of those moments where I don't know if you feel, right now, do you feel good or bad for the Kentuckys and the A&Ms of the world that also happen to be
Missouri
on today.
Missouri's the one I feel bad about, because Kentucky's at least getting a little love.
Right.
A&M, Kevin Sumlin's got under the hot seat pressure talk, so there's conversation there. They've been a meaningful team in the top 10 in the last few years. It's really Missouri that I feel the worst for, because Missouri is the team that's probably going to be picked last. Missouri's the team that's got the coach that's a second-year guy that's sort of a little unproven, and they don't have a lot of star power other than Drew Locke, their quarterback. Basically, Missouri's the one I feel bad for.
Well, Missouri. At this point, you're right. Kentucky is getting a little love. Kentucky, in my mind, is getting a lot of love. But again, that's compared to, I made this analogy earlier. I got to say it again. It's a little like that friend of yours that you're like, they got a job, and if they can just show up to work for a week, you're going to be like, oh, this is fantastic. I think I didn't have very high expectations of Kentucky getting a lot of praise. So it's been surprising to me for the last 24 to 48 to see how many people are desperately hunting for a third team to put ahead of Tennessee. That's sort of what it feels like to me. It's like they are hunting for, could be South Carolina, could be Kentucky. You know, it's
not even like that. And there are some good reasons to be pro-Kentucky. There are some good reasons to love Jake Bentley and the receiving corps for South Carolina. They're going to score a bunch of points. There's a lot of legitimacy to that, and not the least of which is Will Muschamp got them to a bowl game in year one. Derek Mason elevated Vanderbilt to a bowl game. Mark Stoops finally got to a bowl game. So all of these things are viable, legitimate things to say and to consider about these other teams. It doesn't mean that like the Tennessee thing, it's just anti-Tennessee at this point. It's just hey, they burnt us last year. We picked them to win, and they ruined my predictions, and I look stupid, so forget you, Tennessee. I'm going to go against the grain now. Barnhart nailed it. They're going to be picked third. They're going to be picked third. They'll be picked third, I think, with a bullet. I filled out my ballot yesterday. I have Florida 1. I'm not going to reveal the rest of it because it may be a little different than some other people's, but okay. I have the Florida Gators winning the East. But I think that Florida – I think Tennessee is much closer to Florida and Georgia than any of these experts are wanting to admit. And it's all because they got sort of burnt on them last year.
Well, and I think that you're right. I think part of it's because they got burnt on them, and part of it comes back to what feels like just an absolute lack of trust and belief in Butch Jones from people. And as much as people are coming in saying, hey, Butch didn't do as poorly as we thought he would at Media Day, seems to be the sentiment. You know, like, that's not the words.
The bar was very low, and he just barely cleared it.
Hey, you know what? He didn't totally screw that up. That sort of feels like that's where people's mindset has been living the last couple of days at SEC Media Days. And again, I don't know if it's the jaded lover thing. I don't know if it's the expectation thing. But any way you want to look at it, everybody, including our own Jared Stillman, seemed to be completely out on Tennessee and in on anyone desperately other than.
And it's very interesting because what are the two sort of talking points about Tennessee this week? One of them is that it's unacceptable to lose to South Carolina and Vanderbilt. No question about it. You also beat Florida and you beat Georgia and you had a ton of injuries and you still have more talent than the, like, there's two sides of the coin on all these conversations and on every team. There's two sides of the A&M coin. There's two sides of the Kentucky coin. There's two sides. Alabama's the only coin that has one side, and it's just awesome.
You know, speaking of that coin, you know, Nick Saban just walked by. We would like to. I'd like some acknowledgement.
The air actually pushed us back. Like, we actually got brushed back by air.
I'd like some acknowledgement for our restraint. I did not just walk into the circle and hug him.
I don't know why you didn't scream Roll Tide.
You know, or scream.
No one's ever done that to
you.
Nick Saban.
Too good for us, Nick? Nikki? That's what I was screaming.
Little Nikki?
Yeah, I'm like, hey, Nikki, come on over here.
I think that lost in all of this about Tennessee, trying to find these negatives, trying to find these things is that there's a lot to like about this Tennessee program. Like, there's the talent, as Tony Barnhart just said, the depth on this roster is so much better than it has been in the past. They have beaten Florida and Georgia. Like, they're competitive now in the East. So there's a lot of things to like about this Tennessee football team.
A lot of things to like about
Phil Savage to hang out with us here.
A lot of things to like about Phil Savage as well. So we'll let you just hop right into this conversation because I can't decide. I'm hearing a lot of anti-Tennessee stuff in general here, and people seem to want to find a reason for them to be a fourth-place team. You know, I've even heard some guys say, hey, I wouldn't be surprised if they finished fifth. Like, it feels like everyone's bought in on Tennessee's a disappointment. Is this sort of an anti-sentiment? Is it a blowback, a correction from last year's overhype?
Probably so. And I think that the question mark at quarterback, not knowing exactly who it's going to be, for the Vols, the fact that while this offensive line has more experience than it's ever had, how good is this offensive line for the Tennessee Vols? And then, you know, defensively, again, last year decimated by injury. I think there's a high regard for Bob Shoup in the business itself. But, you know, who is the mainstay player now that Derek Barnett is in the NFL? So, I would say their argument, and you guys heard Butch Jones the other day, is that they feel like internally they've got more volume in terms of talent and more depth than they've ever had since he arrived there. And I think they feel like that, look, we probably start off as an 8 to 9 win team and then try to proceed from there. Now, is that reality? I don't know. But the bottom line is that this is Butch Jones' fifth year, and they should be on more stable footing than they have been in his previous seasons.
Phil Savage joining us here, SiriusXM College Sports Nation. He's the play-by-play man for the Alabama Radio Network, and also, or excuse me, color analyst.
Thank you. Eli Gold is the golden voice of Alabama football.
And most importantly, though, of course, executive director of the Reese's Senior Bowl that you can, of course, catch at the end of the season every year as you guys peruse talent. Phil, from a talent standpoint, that's what you do. The SEC lost a boatload of defensive linemen this year into the draft, a lot of guys. There's still a lot of dudes in the SEC that are going to play some good defense. But are we seeing a shift quarterback play improves, defensive line play maybe not as good, maybe some higher scoring games in your
opinion?
Yeah,
it's definitely cyclical. There's no question about it. Of course, last year the SEC had 53 total draft picks. But, Braden, the thing, and you're talking about Tennessee in the East right now, the thing that's interesting to me is you've got Florida, Georgia, and Tennessee, and two of those three have question marks at quarterback going into the season. But there's experience at quarterback when you consider Vanderbilt and Kyle Shurmur, Jake Bentley in South Carolina, Kentucky and Steven Johnson, and then, of course, Missouri with Drew Locke. So in saying that, I think there are going to be some upsets on the eastern side because of that quarterback play and because they're, you know, will Bama be good on defense? Of course. Will they be as dominant as they were last year? Maybe not. But I do think that, look, playing good defense now almost is keeping somebody under 20 points.
Yeah.
You know, it's not 10
points. That's elite. That's elite defense.
That's elite defense. Yeah. And so the game has really evolved and changed before our very eyes over the last half dozen years in a big way. And I think that, you know, people said the spread couldn't work in the SEC, and now virtually every team has some element of the spread offense in their package.
Who is the one team, if you had to pick one, that can actually dethrone Alabama in this process? Or is there none? I'll take none as a fair answer.
Well, I think that it's clear that Bama stands above the rest, certainly going into the season. But you do have to go on the field and prove it. I would look at Auburn. If Jarrett Stidham is as good as what people say and think he will be, when Auburn's had a legitimate, bona fide quarterback, whether it was Cam Newton or Nick Marshall, in their different ways, they've been a challenge for Alabama. You know, you look at LSU, and I was impressed with Coach O the other day in terms of him revisiting his history at Ole Miss and basically saying, I'm going to be more hands-off. I'm going to allow these coordinators to do their job. I think if Matt Canada is as successful as people think, and we know what Dave Aranda can do, LSU certainly can recruit on an annual basis and stay on the field with Alabama from a talent standpoint. And, you know, to me, those would be the two teams. I'm not sure there's anybody in the East that's ready for that challenge yet if it comes to a title game in December.
How many coaching vacancies are there at the end of the year in the SEC?
Wow. You know, I think that the reality of it is that when the athletic director, Scott Woodward at Texas A&M, comes out and basically, you know, it's one thing to have external pressure or heat. It's another to have internal. And it seems like there is some internal angst at A&M with Kevin Sumlin. I don't know if they're good enough to go win 10 or 11 games, and I'm not sure that 7 or 8 or 9 is going to be enough. When you look at that situation, of course, we'll have him on Sirius XM later today over on the college side of things. And, you know, the rest, I mean, to me, Vandy, Kentucky, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, they're all in good standing. Tennessee, I think the powers to be understand that Butch Jones is there for the long haul. We'll see if he can get to a breakthrough year. In that regard, but they did make a change at the athletic director spot. That's always a little bit uneasy for a coach. But at the end of the day, Braden, I would say, you know, maybe two.
Yeah.
You know, maybe two.
Follow him on Twitter at Senior Bowl Phil, one of the best minds in the business. And next time, bring us peanut butter cups. I know usually.
Yeah, dude, I know you've got like stacks of them upstairs.
You know, peanut
in
butter
the
cups
room,
is where,
okay?
Like, that's the single greatest.
We put the players first.
Well, and then what he'll do and what he does in the Sirius XM room is he'll have Kevin Sumlin designing plays with Reese's peanut butter cups. There'll be formations out there, and then they'll motion one cup over here, and then this cup goes deep, and then that cup's wide open.
First time I ever went to the Senior Bowl, all I did was take everybody's peanut butter cups. Somebody just walked up and down. I'm like, y'all don't want these. So follow him, obviously. Phil, we appreciate your time today,
good
man.
To catch up with both of you, Braden and Fitz.
It's good,
good
man.
Good to see you, Beth.
Well, we're going to go from peanut butter cups from the dessert. We'll go to the main meal.
So, Chick-fil-A?
Gary right. Stokin from Chick-fil-A going to join us. We'll get you caught up on the Tennessee-Georgia Tech Monday night kickoff game. That's the Chick-fil-A kickoff game. We'll talk about that next. Braden and Fitz, ESPN, 102.5 The Game. He's Braden Gall. I'm Jason Fitz. You're listening to Braden and Fitz on ESPN, 102.5 The Game. And don't forget, guys, ESPN 1025 The Game wants you to sign up for our $5,000 home improvement contest. You can go to thegamenashville.com. Register to win $2,500 of furniture and bedding from Atlantic Bedding and Furniture, along with your own spa, valued at $2,500 from Four Winds Spa. It's fantastic. Brought to you by Atlantic Bedding and Furniture. Your style, your budget, Four Winds Spa. Relax, you've earned it. And your friends at ESPN 1025 The Game. Braden and I are down in Hoover, Alabama at SEC Media Days, and we just got really hungry. This is what happens. So really stoked about this. Obviously, we've been talking.
I see what you did there, stoked.
Yeah, you see.
Yeah, see what you did
there. Yeah.
So we've been talking about, obviously, a ton of college football over the course of the last few days. But this one's cool to me because Gary Stokin comes on, president, CEO from the Chick-fil-A kickoff game. Florida State, Alabama, Saturday, September 2nd. Let's start with the most important thing that everybody on Twitter wants to know. Do we have the power with you to get one Chick-fil-A somewhere to open on Sundays? That's really the question. I understand the stance.
You ever had this question before, Gary?
Oh, yeah.
It's the power. Our listeners need to know that we tried everything we could. So I have to ask. You have to say no.
Well, I'll tell you a great story. Chick-fil-A will never open on Sunday because Truett Cathy, when he was living, great guy, my favorite businessman of all time. Truett told his kids, Dan, Trudy, and Bubba, he said, I'll turn the company over to you, but you have to sign this document. And the document had two things in it. Number one is you'll always stay closed on Sunday. And number two, you'll never take the company public.
Wow.
And he said, if you'll sign this, I'll turn the keys of the company over to you. This was, Truett's probably dead, 5 years ago now. So it was probably 7 years ago. And they quickly signed that, smart kids that they were.
Yes.
And Chick-fil-A will never be open on Sunday. But I think it's for the right reasons. True, it felt like on Sunday you should be with your family, you should go to church, and you should enjoy your family, whether it's doing nothing or, doing their sporting events or dance events or whatever they're doing. He thought family time was very important. But another funny story to that, Warren Buffett, who Truett met through Coca-Cola, which is one of, obviously, the biggest clients that Coca-Cola has. Warren went up to Truett and he said, Truett, you need to take this thing public. You know how much money you'd make and how much money you'd be worth? And so Warren spent a year visiting with Chick-fil-A people, operators, et cetera, corporate people. And he came back after a year and he told Truett, he said, Truett, never take this company public. He said, what you have is fantastic. And now you look at Chick-fil-A, they went from a $4 billion company to an $8 billion company, and their growth is still ahead of them. And they do a great job, and they're great people, and we're proud to have them as a partner.
Well, it's a great partnership for the Peach Bowl, and it's not just, and we'll get into
now the, you're making me hungry.
We'll get into the kick. Don't you know people? Like, can't you make something happen? So we'll get into the kickoff classics. I think the proliferation of these neutral site sort of paid games, I think, is A, good for the sport, good for communities, good for business, all that stuff. We'll get to that. But I want to know how the playoff, sort of your first trip through the playoff run as one of those bowls, the Peach Bowl sort of getting back into that mix and now being a part of the playoff, did we learn anything about that process with Alabama and Washington? How has that changed? Did you learn anything from that process that will go into how you address bowls and these situations before or in the future?
I think some of the challenges were unique in that, the charters, it's going to sound strange, but the charter systems for bowl games now is becoming very difficult. With flights becoming so packed and basically the airlines moving flights around to get capacity, to the extent where we even had Delta, who's one of our partners, meet with the college football playoff and do contracts for the semifinal teams and the championship teams so that they can actually have planes available to charter all the people to where they need to get to, because it's a quick turnaround in a week. And, that's something that probably is not as interesting, but that was something that really caught me off guard and was unique. We've been through so many sellouts, and we've been through the big games in the Chick-fil-A Peach Bowl and the kickoff game that, my staff just first class. They do a wonderful job. Our volunteers are fantastic. That we really didn't get surprised with a whole lot. And we've had Alabama,
right,
five times over the last 10 years, so we knew how they worked. And Washington, Coach Peterson is just, one of the best. So, yeah, it was really a fun experience to have a semifinal game. Now, there were some unique things in
hosting the media, you know, on media day and on the field of the Georgia Dome. There were some things that we had to do, but for the most part, we ran our play like we normally run our play for the Chick-fil-A Peach Bowl.
Now, you mentioned unique, and obviously this year going into the kickoff game, there's a chance at history. We've never seen the number one and number two teams play each other on the opening weekend of a season, and that's a real opportunity when you talk about Florida State, Alabama. It's Saturday, September 2nd, by the way, guys, 8 p.m. Eastern, ABC. We know it's special, and it changes it for the media standpoint. Our eyeballs get big. But for you guys that have done so many big matchups and so many big events, what does it do to you guys and when you look at this, your excitement?
Well, one unique thing we did for this game is I said we've got to come up with a theme. We've got to come up with a slogan. So my staff did a great job of coming up with the GOAT game, the greatest opener all time.
Ooh, I like that.
And so we're calling this the GOAT game. And, you know, to your point, I mean, we've never seen in the history of 149 years of college football a number one against number two or number one against number three play in the opening game. So, yeah, it's going to be fantastic. And then to think about it, it's going to be in a new stadium, the world's greatest stadium. And then to think about it's being the first game of the year. I credit Jimbo Fisher and Nick Saban for, A, wanting to play in games like this, but that's the kind of programs they want. They want their kids to compete at the highest level. And so this doesn't, you know, have any negative connotations to it whatsoever. They think it's all upside. And I agree with them because now with the CFP, this game, even if you lose, and if you take care of your own business and win your conference, you're in the playoff. Yep. So what's unique as well, we may see number one against number two on the start of the season and at the end of the season in the same city, in the same stadium, which would really – I mean, be unbelievable. You couldn't write that script.
And just real quickly, obviously Tennessee and Georgia Tech on Monday evening, our audience certainly big, very passionate about that. Do you think these games in general, and you know, quickly here, there's so many of these neutral site games, it's good for everybody. It's good for the fans, it's good for the teams, it's good for the corporate sponsorship, it's good for the economies. Are we going to see more than just week one, week two on these? Do we see these extending into the regular season further and further?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I can tell you we're already talking in 2020 about going past week one because it's so difficult to schedule these. You know, I love home and homes. I think that should be the bread and butter of college football. But it's so difficult to get schedules sometimes arranged. And so these neutral one-off games become the way to go because they are win-win-wins financially, et cetera, et cetera. But, yeah, I think you're going to see in the future. I'd like to do a basketball-football doubleheader.
Ooh,
oh, that's a great idea.
I'd like to take two teams.
Now we're talking, like early November?
Yeah, in November when basketball starts, bring two teams, same teams in town, all their fans, play basketball in Phillips Arena one night and football in the Mercedes-Benz Stadium the next night.
I'm in.
I'm in for that, too.
So
I think that's my next concept.
Hopefully I can get that done.
Gary Stokin from Chick-fil-A, from the kickoff game, from the Peach Bowl. Fantastic work by you guys.
Oh, thanks.
This is an exciting time for college football fans. You're a huge part of it. We appreciate you coming on the show.
Well, we appreciate it and look forward to seeing you guys. Yeah. Brandon, good to see
thanks,
you again.
Gary.
Obviously, we're going to continue to talk about this for the next several months because you have Saturday, September 2nd, 8 p.m. Eastern, Florida State, Alabama. That same weekend, Tennessee versus Georgia Tech. They continue to give us great matchups that open the college football season. It's good for the sport. It's good for all of you. Coming up next, Steve Shaw, the SEC Director of Officials. We're going to find out how the Director of Officials feels the state of officiating is in the SEC. We'll do that next up on Braden and Fitz, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Buck Rising is back at The Game National Studios, presented by Wholesale Inc. of Mount Juliet. He's Braden Gall. I'm Jason Fitz. We are down in Hoover, Alabama, thanks to the good folks at Pepper Boxing, Volunteer, Hose and Gasket, and Transportation from Walker Chevrolet. So we're down here because it gives us an opportunity to get face-to-face to so many people that are key in the SEC, from players to analysts to coaches to some of the behind-the-scenes people. And so we're joined by one of those now, Steve Shaw, SEC Director of Officials. Thanks for taking some time with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I always want to be behind the scenes. When I have to go to the front line, it's not a good day.
Well, and sort of like a great offensive line, the only time that officials get noticed is when they have a perceived mistake. So we are very big. We want to make sure with a guy like Steve here, very important, that we have a philosophy on the show that no fan base should ever blame an officiating crew ever for a loss, ever. So we just want to make sure we're on your side.
Well, I appreciate that.
I want to let you know
that. I appreciate that. So,
so that being said.
But your message is still struggling to get out, I'm going to tell you.
So I do want to address a couple things because I think part when you're in Sports Talk Radio, part of your job is to – I get to ask you questions that every fan has wanted to ask. So in this process, I'll go straight to it. There's a perception whenever a call is blown that a ref is in some way biased. Yep. How do you guys, when you're looking at these guys and you're judging these guys, how do you judge them to make sure that that's not part of an issue?
Yeah, so we do have, and I'm going to change your vernacular a little bit. So we do have incorrect calls occasionally. Okay,
sure.
We don't have blown calls or horrible calls, but we do have incorrect calls. And one thing the fans should know is we evaluate every call, every play is graded from a film perspective, just like the players. They get a grade on every play. And we do have, you know, unfortunately, you know, we strive for perfection, but, you know, we're not going to reach that. And so what our goal is, you know, the things that we miss, we have to learn from. But we track everything. If there's bias in there, an official won't be around. And when I say track everything, we're looking at, you know, foul reports. How many fouls do you call on the sideline you're on versus the other sideline, the home versus the visitors? I mean, it's across the board. And if there's any bias in that, you know, official won't be around.
Let me ask you a follow-up to that then.
Okay.
Because I know coaches get a lot of that information to them. They know tendencies of different officiating crews. Has there ever been a discussion about essentially within the broadcast making tendencies of crews known? Like, you guys track it. You guys grade it.
The NFL does it.
Has there been any discussion to saying, okay, this guy is this efficient, this guy's this efficient, or that sort of information going to fans?
Well, not going to fans, not even going to the head coaches and athletic directors. You know, what we do, we have a strong evaluation process. We have five things from an annual perspective that we look at and we grade them. So they get an average. So we have observers. The observers all rank and rate every position, you know, top to bottom. We have 9 crews, so 1 to 9 in every position. And then we take a median average of that. They get a film grade every week, so we take an average from that. We have a rules test that they have to take. They have a conditioning component. They have to run a mile and a half. Then I have a personal evaluation that I do in that. And we blend that together. And where that comes out is, you know, from an annual basis, that determines, number one, do you get a bowl assignment? And the officials are just like the teams. I want to qualify for a bowl. And then once I've qualified, I want the best bowl out there. So that grading process does that. And then on top of that, you know, beyond the bowls, it determines, you know, are you going to be invited back next year? What's your status? What crew you're assigned to? So those evaluations are very important to the officials. I mean, not bias, but their own personal evaluation. So you know, I don't think – I know we don't have an official that would say, well, I'll give up a few points on my grade to help this team or that team. It's just not going to happen. And I want you to know, too, we're very, very particular in assignments. So if you're an alumnus of a school, you're not going to work there. But if you have a son or daughter attending there, if it's in your hometown – I mean, we have a number of things. If you have any financial relationship, any business relationship, then you won't work that school. So if I'm a side judge in a crew and we're working that, then we take you out, replace you for that week. So we avoid any potential look of impropriety. But, you know, our official, I mean, once you get an official's perspective, I mean, you're all about pulling for one team, and that's the crew on the field. We always talk about there's 3 teams on that field, and we want to be the best team out there.
And it speaks to something that we tell fans all the time, like, their financial, a referee's financial future is tied directly to doing a good, honest job. And I don't think fans ever want to admit that. Like, if the better job they do at calling the right call is the only way they gain whatever it is they're trying to gain. You mentioned bowl status or moving up on the ladder in the career path. I mean, any of that stuff. So I think we stress that a lot with our audience, and we'll continue to beat the drum on that. Steve Shaw joining us here. My question about sort of the evolution of the game, as you guys sit down and evaluate what is the biggest issue and problem as we move forward? Certainly targeting became a thing, and the health of the athlete's a big thing right now. What is the big officiating concern that you guys are anticipating for the next few years because of the evolution of the game and how it's changed?
Well, the first is player safety. You hit it right up front. And, you know, the targeting rule is working well. You know, a lot of fans don't like it, the disqualification component. But without the disqualification component, it would not have the impact that it has in changing player behavior. And you guys know, I mean, the most precious commodity to a player is what? Playing time. And when you impact that, I mean, we saw that on helmets coming off. You know, helmets were coming off.
That changed quickly,
didn't it? and then we just took one play. They had to go out for one play, and they still come off, but not at the frequency that they did. And so when you impact playing time, that has an impact. But everything we have, every new rule is viewed in the lens of player safety. So, you know, there will not be any backup on targeting. We made changes last year to allow replay to have more flexibility. They can actually make a targeting call from the booth now. They can look at all aspects. They used to could only see, was there forcible contact to the head or neck area? Now they can look, was there a launch, was upward thrust, was there a targeting action in that? And so we'll have no back off there. But the things that are primary are around player safety. We've done a big survey about blocking below the waist. What are we going to do with that? We're going to get good feedback from coaches around that. So player safety will continue to be in that. And I think, you know, the rules committee are looking at things, you know, and we have now a competition committee that even look broader. You know, what's the fan experience like? You know, one of the big concerns is timing of the game. The games are taking too long. The rules committee didn't want to change the rule to take plays out of a game or whatever. But they've come to us now as officials and said, look, administratively, you've got to keep this game moving. Halftime is going to be, you know, it's always been 20 minutes, but it really wasn't 20 minutes. You know, it was 24, 25, you know, coach interview by TV, then the radio guys, and then, you know, then they had a presentation to a booster, and we were 4 minutes before we started the 20-minute clock. This year, when the half's over, we're going to start the clock. When the clock hits zero, we're going to hand, the center judge is going to hand the ball to the kicker. He's going to kick it off. The media, the you know, CBS and ESPN with us, all the flavors of ESPN, they're well aware of this. They're going to have to be more efficient. We're going to get in and out of timeouts faster. We're going to be very consistent on when prescribed by rules starting the clock. So what the rules committee wants around keeping the game moving, and it's not hurrying the game or hurrying to get it over, it's to keep the game moving. They want us now, before we make a big rule change, let's look at all the administrative components. Let's get that going. And I always felt as an on-field official, if your game was crisp and moving, things happen better. If it bogs down and slows down, then players don't play as well. We have issues. You know, officiating is not as good. So keeping the game moving is good for the fan, good for the game. But number of issues, but it'll all be around player safety and health and well-being of our student-athlete.
We're talking to Steve Shaw, SEC Director of Officials. I know we got to go. One more quick one. There's a perception that referees are worse than ever. I think you've got some interesting data that supports the opposite theory. Tell us why you feel like things are better today than they have been.
Well, so that's a long discussion in a short window. The technology that we have today is making our officials better. Now, let me just say, the game gets tougher to officiate every year. It gets faster, the up-tempo. And so we have to up our game every year just to maintain what we have. But I'm going to tell you, you know, the hardest thing we face, you know, I thought my role, and it was in the early days, you know, find the best officials, train them up, get them ready, and put them in the game. Now, you know, how do we respond to the world out there? You know, now everybody that has a cell phone, a DVR, and a big screen TV, you know, is a critic, is a blogger, is a whatever, and we're overwhelmed, and there's no way you can respond to everything. So how we're trying to figure out, how do we respond, when do we respond, how do we do it? And quite frankly, we are a little overwhelmed there. How do we do that? But officiating, there's more expectation than ever before. I'll use an example. So I was a longtime referee. You know, before HD and even with coaches film, you know, one of the toughest calls as a referee is pass fumble. You know, the quarterback pass fumble. But I'm going to tell you, in the day, when you got the coaches film on Sunday, I mean, we didn't know. I mean, yeah. I called it incomplete. You couldn't tell from that film. Now, HD look, all the cameras, you can see, you know, inch movement of that hand. And so now what we see is so much more. And so the expectation goes higher. We have to get better. But I'm telling you, our guys are better. They have to be better just to maintain. And I'm proud, you know, we're day-to-day, everything, you know. But, you know, the last few years, our guys have really had good years. I mean, you know, we've had fender benders, but not the big train wreck. And that's where you want to be. And you know, the last thing I'll say, our guys work their tails off at it. This is not a fall job anymore. It's a year-round deal. Our guys, clinics, weekly rule quizzes. I mean, they've really not had a summer off. And now, you know, in 2 weeks, they'll be back in Birmingham. And, you know, then it's on for the season.
Steve Shaw, SEC Director of Officials, joining us. We appreciate your time, man, and your honesty. It's a great conversation. We'll continue to have the conversation. Absolutely. And also, some conversation happened yesterday between an SEC coach and somebody that works on this station. We'll tell you what happened. Next up, Braden and Fitz, ESPN 102.5 The Game.